and welcome to the third episode of the Confluence Mailbag Podcast. I'm Bill O'Grady, Advisory Director at Confluence Investment Management. Joining me today, as always, is Mark Keller, CEO and CIO at Confluence. The idea behind this podcast is to replicate the Q&A sessions, the A.G. Edwards Investment Strategy Committee's open mic sessions from earlier in this century. Again, to submit questions, email us at mailbag@confluenceim.com. Each month, we select 4 to 5 of the most common, provocative, and interesting questions we receive, and Mark and I will address them. So, without further ado, let's tackle the first one. Small caps have underperformed for nearly a decade versus the S&P 500. With tariffs, inflation, higher interest rates, and worries about slower economic growth, will small caps ever outperform again? How do we rank the attractiveness of mega, large, mid, small caps in the current market environment? Well, Mark, got any ideas on this?
Oh, lots of ideas on this. Well, you know, that first part of that question really caught my attention here. Small caps have underperformed for nearly a decade, and have they? The answer is no, but we get confused by the endpoint sensitivity of compound annual growth rates. In fact, you could go back for 20 years, and since 2005 to 2025, August, and small caps have returned about 7.7% annually, whereas large caps, 10.7%. So there's 300 basis points. Wow. Why would I ever invest in small caps? Well, the fact is they were, up until 4.5 years ago, they were right on top of each other. From 2005 to March of 2021, they were 9.9 versus 10.0. I mean, in other words, their performance was roughly in line. But since then, in the last 4.5 years is when this has really blown out. Small caps, and I'm using the Russell 2000's total returns and S&P 500, and I know every index has issues and problems, but just kind of ignoring that for the moment. For the last 4.5 years, the return, compound annual return of the Russell 2000 has been 0.1%. In other words, flat, no return, while the S&P 500 has returned 13.1% annually. That's the massive difference, and that's produced, you know, just this huge gap that we all are aware of and feeling right now. There was evidence that this gap was starting to open up in 2019. And about 6 years ago, when the Magnificent Seven really started to gain consciousness, and I also kind of credit Warren Buffett's big buying of Apple in 2018 as kind of giving legitimacy to a very broad swath of investors to go after these. Why did that Mag 7 really start to take off? Well, I think part of it has to do with just the fact that the profit profile of major tech companies had changed dramatically over the previous 10 years. And that was starting to be recognized. That is, we started to see software and internet business models started to generate huge operating leverage. As they did, we started to get network effects going with the internet and unchecked monopoly power on top of that. The result was, for companies of huge size, they began growing their profits very rapidly. And, you know, the excellent outperformance over 100 years of small caps has to do with the fact that being small, they can grow more rapidly on a percentage basis. When companies get big, their growth rates, while being perhaps more stable, tend to slow down. Well, here, because of these characteristics, we started to see these very large companies grow fast and even faster. The COVID kind of brought them together. The small caps outperformed dramatically coming out of the COVID sell-off. But then, since then, it's been all AI all the time. And that has given a huge boost to these Mag 7 and related large caps. And it really, that's where most of the earnings and stock performance has come from in the S&P 500. It hasn't come from the broad group of large caps per se, but in this relatively narrow, and it's really not just 7 stocks, there's several dozen that have been producing this return. Investor excitement has just gotten to be extraordinary. And I think we're at the place where we're starting to ask, is it overdone?
Yeah, indexing, I think, has played a role in this as well. Mm-hmm. Mike Green, who's a prominent Substacker and over at Simplify Asset Management, has done a lot of research on this. And, you know, it's kind of one of these error of composition problems. for an individual investor, indexing is really hard to beat. I mean, you're getting market performance, and the costs have been slashed to the point where it's not quite free, but it's bordering on free. The problem is that what is good for the individual may not be good for in mass. In other words, everybody engaging in behaviors that are rational at the micro level can turn out to be disastrous at the macro level. And I think we're seeing, this is another example of this, is that, you know, if every 2 weeks or every month a 401k is following the logic of send me money, and I put it in the index on a capitalization weighted basis, that's a price insensitive buyer. They're not looking at what I'm buying. I'm just buying the index, and it went up last month, and if it goes up this month, I do the same thing, and you just keep doing it. And you know, we think all the time about, well, what's the catalyst that's going to break this? And well, recession might do it, but a recent report I wrote in the Asset Allocation Biweekly, you know, recessions are really becoming few and far between. And, you know, we've kind of always worked from Joseph Schumpeter's idea that, well, you know, you need these recessions to kind of clear out the underbrush. That might not actually be the problem. The problem is that it becomes, you don't do anything to stop the further concentration of the market. You couple that with lax antitrust activity. You know, one of the tricks we're seeing now among the really large tech companies is that they don't buy these firms. They just go in and they hire all the top personnel, and you know, the rump that remains just withers away. And if all you're buying is intellectual property, if you hire the intellects, you kind of bought the company. And you know, I know you think about this a lot. I think about it too, and I struggle to figure out what's going to stop this train.
Yeah, you know, it's a massive momentum play really underway here, and momentum plays build upon themselves. And as you properly pointed out, the force factor here is index buying. You know, you've got, you know, top 10 stocks getting, it's getting close to 40% of the market here, or the index. So what's going to change? I don't know. Our old friend, your old boss, Al Goldman, used to say the trend will stay in place until it changes. And that was, you know, that was a way of saying that, you know, something will happen and you really can't tell what it is and you don't know when it's going to happen. I will say that there are some worrisome things from a fundamental business point of view. There's some worrisome things about the valuations that some of these companies are getting and have risen to, particularly since the AI fuse got lit when ChatGPT was introduced about 3 years ago. And, you know, it's and I would say it's not just, as I indicated before, not just small caps or large caps, but it's everything versus, you know, stocks that are worth over about 100 billion market cap or more. I will say this one other thing. Be careful about just looking, even though I just used the Russell 2000 as a, you know, as a proxy, there aren't too many good ones. You know, as of not too many months ago, about 42% of the Russell 2000 companies are unprofitable.
Yeah.
They don't make money. So there's a lot of cats and dogs in there. If you're wondering what it is for the S&P 500, it's 6%. For the mid-cap, Russell mid-cap index is 14%. In other words, that Russell index and virtually all small-cap indices just have a lot of companies with checkered businesses. So compare quality companies to quality companies when you do this kind of comparison.
Another thing to keep in mind is, you know, the regulations that came out of the early part of the century may have actually exacerbated that problem.
I think so.
You know, really good small companies tend not to IPO anymore. They get sold directly to, you know, their larger counterparts. So to some extent, what's left, what actually goes public, may not be the best companies.
That's exactly right. There's very very few high quality small cap IPOs anymore. If they're really good, private equity sucks them up.
Right.
And then when they sell again, they often go to another private equity company.
Or they go to, you know, a larger firm. mm-hmm. and they just mm-hmm. buy the asset before it ever actually hits the public market.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're not in that trend. They're not doing, I mean, the quality ones aren't doing badly by, you know, very long-term standards, but there's, can they keep up with, you know, this enormous AI-driven trend and indexation trend? No.
They don't, don't get the momentum from, you know, the indexing that comes through the retirement programs. And, you know, so you end up in a situation where, this is a really great company that's undervalued, but if it can't attract attention and it can't attract liquidity, mm-hmm. it just sits there. It doesn't mean it's not a good thing to own, no. but you just don't get the return.
Yeah, and my own kind of view on this, even though as businesses, if I were going to go out and buy one of these businesses at the price offered, it's a lot more small caps look more interesting mm-hmm. to me than these mega caps. But this trend is going to continue until it changes, as we said. And we saw this back in 2000 when the internet bubble just, you know, went to the moon. And, you know, you get to a place where, you know, your grandmother is cashing in her CDs to buy NVIDIA. When you get to that level, bad things can happen. You don't need a recession to do it. And right. We had a recession came after the bubble burst. I still, to this day, don't know what it was on March 16th of 2000 that caused the S&P 500 to peak. But when these things roll over, they roll over. And if there's anything that's going to stop people from just allocating to the index and their 401ks, they're going to have to see something like that happen.
Well, I do remember, and that's one of the advantages of having old guys on your podcast, is that we've lived through lots of stuff. I was talking to advisors around 2001, 2002 that were asking me, well, how do I stop my wealthy client from selling out of their stocks to buy residential real estate? And we have tended to go from bubble to bubble because the financial system and the government policy create too much liquidity. Too long cash has not been considered an asset class. And I guess the thing that haunts me most about the current market environment is that we've got about $3 trillion sitting in retail money market funds. And if the Fed cuts rates aggressively, a lot of that money is going to get chased out, and it's most likely to go to the place of least resistance, which is more of the, mm-hmm. more of the large cap, mega cap. Mm-hmm. And so this potentially could get a lot worse before it gets better. I'll leave one last thing on this topic. A recent Odd Lots podcast interviewed a man that runs a small furniture business in Alaska. It was fascinating. He was, you know, they were asking him, well, how do tariffs affect your business? And one of the things that comes out is that if you're a small business, the tariffs are buffeting a lot mm-hmm. of small businesses because mm-hmm. they lack the market power to pass price increases along. In addition, they lack the buying power to not have the higher tariff applied to them, whereas larger companies can go to their suppliers and say, you know, I think we're going to share this burden and you're going to share it a lot more than I do. You know, this isn't just simply another factor weighing on them. At this point, it's too early to know how big a deal it is. But when we hear reports that, well, businesses are eating a lot of these tariffs, I think a lot of the eating is occurring at the below mega cap level.
No doubt about it. We were kind of sketching this out before it happened, you know, when the size of the tariffs were made clear in April. And yeah, you know, the mega retailers, be it Walmart, Amazon, you know, if you're doing private label t-shirts or shirts for Walmart in Vietnam, you know, they just turn to you and say, eat it.
Yep.
And you eat it. But little guy, clothing store on Main Street cannot do that, and they've got to pass it on, and it just widens the competitive gap. Yeah, it's we're already seeing this, and anecdotally, when I talk to businessmen in the medium size and smaller, it's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Question number two, what do you think about the U.S. government adoption of the crypto space and subsequent regulatory framework for stablecoins? Over the past several years, we've seen exchanges hacked, dollar-pegged coins fail, a Luna Terraform debacle. Is there benefit to being the global leader in crypto and the concept of private money, or conversely, is this an initiative that could set up the next financial crisis? Well, I will tell you, I've been spending a lot of time on stablecoins, and from a theoretical perspective, they are absolutely fascinating. First of all, the current Genius Act, at least to me, appears like it's more inclined to encourage the issuance of private stablecoins. There's an old line that have been attributed to Hyman Minsky, but it could have been attributed to a number of other people too, where he said anybody can print money. The trick is getting someone else to accept it. The collateral rules in the Genius Act, effectively it's near government or government money market funds that can't pay interest. You know, there's a huge incentive for private firms to generate these things because they get to earn the interest on the bills or whatever they use for collateral or the repo. And by law, they can't pass that along. Now, you could see a major retailer issuing their own stablecoin and saying, hey, you use this Amazon or Walmart stablecoin, we'll give you a 2% discount. You could easily see the situation where somebody walks across the street and is like, gosh, I don't have enough money to pay for this, but I do have these wall coins, and the other retailers saying, yeah, I'll accept it, but you're going to take a haircut. We went through this before, actually, after Andrew Jackson, President Jackson, killed the Second Bank of the United States. We had what was called the free banking period, and banks issued their own money. In fact, the term Dixie comes from a bank in New Orleans that issued such good money that people treated it as it had a very good exchange rate far beyond the state of Louisiana. And because of the French overtones, they called the tin the Dix, and thus became the Dixie. So in some respects, stablecoins are a walk back to a much earlier period. Now, the payment rails are such that you could easily see a situation where, you know, the current in the United States, you know, the current payment rails work really efficiently. You know, your credit card will do so much for you. You could easily see, however, those margins getting squeezed. You know, that the threat of stablecoin will force those firms to reduce the fees that they charge. On the other hand, what this does for the world is also really fascinating. So you're in a country where the currency is regularly debased. Having the easy ability to own dollars in a stablecoin account, even if it doesn't pay you interest, is worth a fortune. And you could easily see a situation where this becomes kind of universalizes the dollar throughout the world, not in the developed world, but in the global south and the emerging world. I mean, you know, think of a person trying to make a living in Lebanon. Gosh, these stable coins are going to really look attractive. Even if they're issued by Walmart or Amazon, they're going to look attractive. One of the other interesting quirks is that unlike what we're seeing in China and Europe and the BRICS countries, doesn't look like the Federal Reserve is going to be able to actually issue one, which, you know, there's a game we used to play called Choose Your Dystopia, and you're going to choose 1984 Brave New World. Well, guess what, kids? We're heading into Brave New World. So I also note that the FT is quoting Chinese officials that they're very concerned about this dollar stablecoin issuance. And you could also see that too, because it's going to be really hard to regulate these things if you put them on an app.
You know, one of the slogans of the tech community for many years has been to move fast and break things. And I would contend that the number one thing that gets broken is regulation. We saw this 10 years ago or so with Uber, you know, and I kept thinking, well, you know, they can't do that. There's taxi commissions, you know, and all this stuff. And, just wave their hand. We don't need no taxi commissions. And sure enough, they broke it. And I'm glad you have focus on stablecoins, where I think that's what's really interesting is going on here. Walmart, for most of the last 20 years, has showed up in Washington every few years and tried to start a bank, the Walmart Bank. And thumbs down every single time. All kinds of constituencies coming out. They won't give them a charter. Stablecoins just go right around that. What you just described, Walmart issue stablecoin, is basically allows them to, you know, issue their own currency and have their own payment system outside of the banking system. Yeah. And if the regulation doesn't catch up to that, that's exactly what's going to happen. And not only bad news for banks, it's bad news for payment systems. Mm-hmm. All those companies in the great chain of transactions when you use a credit card. Yeah, regulation is always slow to catch up, but these days it is so far behind. So when you get an administration that is proposing stablecoins and kind of creating rules and regs to allow this to happen, I wonder how many of them are thinking about what it does potentially to the banking system.
Well, there's an element within the fintech community that really wants to beat the banking system up. So there's an element that's actively trying to undermine them. Mm-hmm. You know, the banks are pretty well positioned. They'll figure out at some point that they'll issue stable coins too. So you'll see JP Morgan mm-hmm. coins and Citi coins and all that. One of the things that hasn't, I think, been thought through. So right now we didn't get a question on this, but there's a lot of drama going on with the relationship between the executive branch and the Federal Reserve. And we're not going to comment in depth on that. But one thing you could see here is that if you have a lot of corporate issues of stable coins, their margin is going to be what they're getting paid on their bills. You could end up in a situation where the lobbying efforts of these firms is to force the Fed not to cut interest rates because it's going to hurt their margins. And I haven't seen anybody talking about this, but in fact, I've heard a lot of people saying, well, you know, at some point this Genius Act will be relaxed and they'll have to start paying interest. And I'm kind of like, well, I don't think so. I think this is the benefit of issuing these things mm-hmm. is to earn. I mean, it's the old Regulation Q issue that we had in the 60s and 70s where banks couldn't pay interest on checking deposits. And, you know, we had all kinds of disintermediation issues. This time around, really kind of what you're creating from a depositor's point of view. If a depositor really just wants safety, they really don't care about how much money they're earning on their cash, because there's all kinds of opportunities in the West, you know, in the developed financial markets to take your cash and do stuff with it. But if you want someplace that's going to be really, really safe, we saw this with whenever you get a major bank failure, you start to see deposits chased into the really large banks. Well, now they're going to get chased into stable coins. So there is a lot going on here. I think the stable coin, frankly, is a lot more interesting than anything else happening. I mean, you've got discussions going on in other elements of crypto, what I refer to as the store value crypto, which is Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then you've got just this mass of private issuers of uncertain money. I don't know if that really ends up going anywhere or not. But the stable coins, it's a revolution. And we're present at the revolution, which is kind of neat. The issue that we'll be watching, though, is how does this play out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's too soon to tell, but that's where the excitement is. Bitcoin, as we kind of surmised a while ago, it's kind of turned into digital gold, really. Yeah. It's a
Although
store
it's,
value.
Its behavior is weird because it tends to, unlike gold, it tends to be directly correlated to risk.
Yeah, it's much more highly correlated with NVIDIA and AI than gold is. Mostly, I think it has something to do with the character and nature of the buyers.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah. Third question. In recent quarters, your asset allocation models, we've seen major swings in and out of asset classes, taking both risk on, risk off. Even when the economy seems to be marching along, is this going to be the norm going forward? Is this high turnover to be expected? Do you think this could be problematic as things change? You know, the swings that we've seen in tariff policy, for example. You mentioned that they have a halftime meeting at mid-quarter to assess how recent changes are performing. Is it possible to make small tweaks? And if you look at aggressive growth, the three-year standard deviation appears close to 17% in your quarterly commentary. Why not use a full allocation of 20%? Are you leaving opportunities on the table? So lots to unpack there. I'll take the lead here. We have had some swings in positioning in reaction to policy shifts in Washington, and we do try our best to avoid these situations. But, you know, the rapid swings in policy have been pretty unique. I've really can't think of anything in history where the swings have been this wide in this short amount of time. But to give you a little background, this is a cyclical asset allocation program, which separates it from strategic with rarely ever changes and tactical, which uses like momentum to change. We really do this based off the business cycle. Well, we've had several previously reliable indicators of the economy signal recession and up to date, at least up to now, have been just dead wrong. I mean, leading indicators started signaling a recession at the end of 2022. The yield curve's been inverted and gone positive. This is the first time in my career we've ever had a false positive from the yield curve. we've been cautious on the economy because of these signals, but they've been overwhelmed. Part of this is that I think we've seen unusually strong fiscal support. You know, it's been running about 5%. Deficit's been running about 5% of GDP consistently. The other is that I think we may be seeing recessions in certain elements of the economy, certain segments of the economy, but just not enough weakness to broadly bring the whole economy down. We had a situation similar to this in the late 80s. We used to refer to them as rolling recessions. So geographically, for example, the oil patch went into a deep downturn in the after the oil price cracked in 1985. You know, places like Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma were just absolutely devastated. The rest of the country did just fine. I think the bottom 40% of households right now are probably in recession. And, you know, that's terribly unfortunate for them. But those folks don't buy equities. So their being in recession, frankly, doesn't have much of an effect on the equity market. You know, tariffs have had a really unusual impact on economic variables. The theory postulates that if you have tariffs, you get a currency appreciation. We've seen just the opposite this time around. I think some of this is worries about credibility of American policy. I don't really see any less uncertainty going forward.
No, listen, we've been doing this asset allocation business together and with our team for, you know, about 24 years. This is not the first time that we got whipsawed, is what, you know, it's basically what happened. And you pointed to it, this dramatic changes in the administration. One of the reasons I got fooled was, like a lot of us, followed Trump for a long time. Maybe other people haven't, but in our industry, yeah, we paid attention to him for at least 30 years. He's made very plain his affection for tariffs as an economic policy tool. So when he surprised us in April by rolling out tariffs much larger and broader than we expected, I wasn't happy because I knew it would likely lead to recession, but I wasn't surprised either. And I wasn't shocked. I was surprised by the size of him, but knowing his desire to use tariffs, he's getting out the sledgehammer. He's really going to. And that led me to be, you know, in light of inverted yield curve, all the other stuff you just mentioned, the probabilities of recession has just skyrocketed here. And then, of course, within a few weeks, he's changing enough to lower the risk of recession, not to zero for certain, but to lower it dramatically. And I have not in my career seen this many policy changes this fast. We've seen previous administrations make policy changes quickly, but maybe not so broadly over such a large range of issues. Well, just last week, you know, we had tariffs on gold bars go from 0% to 39%. And then this morning, I think they're back to zero.
They
again.
Are, yeah.
You know, if I were a trader in the gold market, I'd you had a chance to either make a lot of money or lose a lot of money very quickly. And this is the kind of thing that's been happening. I hope it settles down. I'm getting exhausted, but
or inured.
Or inured to it. But the economy is not that strong. And I really like your analogy of the 80s. We had these rolling recessions. Sometimes we refer to them as regional recessions. Mm-hmm. You know, in the mid 80s, you look at the numbers and there wasn't a recession on the books after we came out of the 81, 82 timeframe. But Agland was in one of the deepest recessions we'd had since the 30s. That's when Farm Aid started and all that stuff. And living out here in the Midwest, we were keenly aware of the recession going on on the farm. In New York, it barely registered a ripple. Things were cheaper on the plate.
Right.
But whereas, you know, the farm states of the upper Midwest were dying. We're kind of seeing something similar like right now where we see parts of the economy really struggling, you know, and I've got friends in the RV business and I monitor that industry because of its sensitivity to interest rates. I mean, if you were to suggest to them that there's not a recession going on, they'd think you're crazy. They've been in a recession for 2 or 3 years now. It's very unusual time in that regard. You know, I've been whipsawed before. I suppose I will be again, but I think we are learning more and we learned a lot about how this administration does things. I think we're going to be a little less quick to move in response to policy change.
I will tell you, it's unsettling when you get caught in one of these whipsaws because you don't like doing it. It's something that we are, I think, getting a better feel for. Mm. The last thing I did want to mention too is this whole volatility concept. We use volatility because we use a mean variance process to as a guideline, but volatility is a poor proxy for risk. Our firm stated position on risk is a catastrophic loss of capital, not whether you vary from an index. We use volatility because it's easy to quantify. It's really hard to quantify catastrophic loss of capital. So whether or not we should spin volatility, that may lead us to actually take on positions that may not make any sense. So we use it the best we can, but we are also keenly aware that volatility by itself is not necessarily a good measure of how much risk you're taking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. And particularly when, well, we've seen this large caps. We were just talking about large caps at the outset. They demonstrably have lower volatility than small caps, yet they've been outperforming for the last 4.5 years dramatically.
Yeah. That's it.
Sometimes taking risk doesn't make you more money.
There's a FT columnist at the end of every year writes up the annual report for Hindsight Capital. And it goes through and says, over the past year, what should you have invested in? And, you know, of course, he's cherry picking all the stuff that just killed it. And they, of course, Hindsight Capital always does really, really well. But when you look at what they come up with, you're like, well, there's no way in a million years any rational person would have put most of these positions on. And so you get back to the whole problem of just because something works doesn't mean it was the right decision. Mm-hmm. There's a book by Annie Duke called Thinking in Bets, and I recommend it to every financial advisor and every investor. It's easy to read, but it also gets back to the point, you know, sometimes you do the right thing, but in a probabilistic universe, it may not work. It just means you've had the odds in your favor.
Mm-hmm.
Next question, and this kind of gets related to this other thing. Any thoughts on supply and demand with respect to the decline of the number of publicly traded companies over time? The why and the ramifications to consider. And for example, 1997, there were 6,500 publicly traded companies. Now there's 4,700, 2023.
Mm-hmm. And I will point out that the number of shares outstanding of those 4,700 stocks has been declining over time, mm-hmm. as companies use their excess cash flow to buy back stock. Using it to buy other companies is less fashionable these days. And frankly, that's not a bad development because we used to always say 50% of all acquisitions don't work out very well. That may be low.
And the other half stink.
Yeah. So using cash flow to buy back stocks is often a good idea. That means the pie, that is the value of the company, is cut into fewer pieces, so you get a bigger piece. And that's good. And you mentioned, cash to torment, trillions of dollars of cash on the sidelines. Yeah, the supply demand for stocks has been skewed toward demand because supply has shrunk. And that is one of the things that's kept this bull market going so strongly, even though the economy really isn't looking all that great.
It's one of those things that points to, you always try to figure out what inning you're in. This might be earlier than we think, because usually one of the end time signals is a raft of IPO issuance, and we're just not seeing
that. Well, and that gets back to the whole private equity thing we were talking about before. Normally at these kind of valuations that we're seeing in tech land, particularly AI, you would be seeing the IPO calendar pile up crazy, but not anymore. There's so much cash, institutional cash, in the private equity and VC markets that those companies get snapped up before they even hit the public. So we're not getting those new shares dumped into the market.
So it's bullish. How difficult will it be to unwind the tariffs? What will future administrations do with them? I will tell you, I think these will not get unwound, in my opinion. It's so hard for the government to raise revenue. And in some respects, tariffs have this unique characteristic of a tax, as they are a revenue source of indeterminate incidents, which means that we're not exactly sure who's paying at any given time. And gosh, that's a great tax from a public from a political standpoint. You know, when you attack somebody directly, they know it and they're not happy about it. But if mm-hmm. you can slip it into them in a way they don't see it as easily, it's going to these are going to become addictive for policymakers, and I don't see them going away.
I've been thinking of this as the American version of the value-added tax.
Yeah, I think that's exactly
it's just
right.
a VAT tax. And once Washington gets used to the revenue, they're not going to give it up.
No. Last question. Given the length of time it takes for a mine to go from discovery to production, do you view minerals like copper, platinum, gold, near-term investment opportunity? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the questioner obviously has been paying attention to mine development. It takes a long time. We used to consider 8 years as the standard development time for a gold mine. It's generally longer than that now. And you think with the tremendous demand that's out there, that surely things will start to, you know. Well, let me tell you, there's no tech bros out there shortening the regulatory situation when it comes to mining. And just being in a jurisdiction that doesn't care about, harming the environment doesn't do it, because those, like, small African countries, they got their hand out in negotiating with them for royalties and maybe ownership of the mine, part ownership of the mine, how many people you're going to hire, all that stuff takes years and years and years. And just when you think you're ready to open it, they change the rules on you.
Yep.
We usually think of 10 to 12 years now to open a mine. Yeah, I think these are excellent areas to invest in. You know, hence, you know, our global hard asset strategy is which we developed a long time ago, is designed to address this. I just caution, however, demand for these minerals is highly cyclical, very much dependent upon economic cycles and developments in China and as well as worldwide. And so even with that long, I think, tailwind of upward and to the right for these metals over the next maybe 20 years, the volatility between highs and lows can be pretty dramatic.
I would add one other element of caution. This is kind of a development we've been monitoring for a little bit now, and it's starting to become a bigger issue as time goes by. We are seeing a world that's deglobalizing. And, you know, early in my career, you would see pretty, in some cases, depending upon the commodity, pretty significant price differences between markets. And globalization has done a remarkable job in arbitraging those price differences away. I think we're heading into a world where that trend is going to reverse. Mm-hmm. And so it's not going to be a matter of just figuring out what commodity to own, but where you own it may turn out to be also a critical decision. You know, you may pick the right commodity in the wrong market. And that's something we haven't really had to think about for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the hoarding that you're seeing starting to go on in some Asian countries of these key minerals and metals, and the signals to do the same in the Western world. I would note the recent decision by the administration to have partial ownership of rare earth companies. This is all part of it. Okay. And I think it's a very exciting area, because, as you well put, this is the one area where you can't move fast and break things nearly as easily. And, but at the same time, the demand is cyclical, and, you know, the demand and the price differences are becoming a much bigger area of concern.
Yeah. U.S. investors are really only familiar with that phenomenon in the natural gas market.
Yeah, it's true.
Where, you know, we pay roughly $3 an MCF here, and over in Europe it's $17.
Yeah.
Why? Because it's really hard to get it from here to there. And that's more of a physics problem. Whereas when you introduce deglobalization, national security politics, what we've seen going on in the rare earth market, which you just referenced, over the last few years could very well become typical of most minerals markets. I mean,
you end up in this, and this is not a hard asset, but if you end up in a situation where the U.S. farmers lose access to Asian markets, gosh, corn and soybeans are going to be dirt cheap here. And they're going to be really dear in those countries. Mm-hmm. And, the ancient business of smuggling rears its ugly head all over again. So this is kind of a back to the future moment for commodities, mm-hmm. to some extent. And, unfortunately, The Mark Riches of the world no longer are with us on this earthly pale, but they were masters at managing these kind of situations, and new ones I'm sure will emerge, but they haven't emerged yet.
Yes. When there's an opportunity, there will be a smuggler.
Well, Mark, thanks for another great session here. I think this is a good place to close it up for today. Again, remind our listeners, if you want to submit a question, send one to mailbag@confluenceim.com. Today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll.